There's a little Colorado cowgirl. She lives in Carolina now. I come from Texas, but I'm cruising to Tennessee, Carolina bound. Met her at a rodeo in Denver. That's where she hog-tied my heart. Between them Wranglers and them big brown eyes, I swore she tore me apart. So now I'm going to Carolina for my Colorado cowgirl. I hope she feels the same, 'cause without my beautiful Colorado cowgirl, this Texas boy would go insane. She's got a 3/4 ton power stroke, dragging that big something D. I wouldn't say this too loud, boys, but I think she rides better than me. She tried to throw me right out of the chute, so I'm trying hard to hang on. And if she'll have me, then it's adios, Texas, Carolina home sweet home. So now I'm going to Carolina for my Colorado cowgirl. I hope she feels the same, 'cause without my beautiful Colorado cowgirl, this Texas boy would go insane.
Yeah, that's the Caleb Dean Band from their self-titled CD with Colorado Cowgirl. The Caleb Dean Band plays at the 3rd Street Center tonight, so scoot them boots over there at 8 o'clock and have you a time. Caleb also plays the temporary over at Takah next Saturday, a week from tomorrow, the last day of September. Well, hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, 7 revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler. And before we get going on today's show, I want to encourage you to call 963-0139 and pledge your support to KDNK. Support the music, support the news, support the public affairs, support the kids, support this program. It's time now to join your friends and neighbors in supporting KDNK. Give us a call, 963-0139. And I was just informed that we just made it over the $50,000 mark. So we can get to our goal of 75, but we can only 75K, but we can only do it with your help. So call us, 963-0139. Well, it's time now for music meeting number 4, which brings music from Colorado Springs, Australia, and France to your ears. Here we are, music meeting 4. Yay!
Oh man, I'm so glad to be back with you gentlemen.
Me too. And I'm glad to pick an obscure Colorado artist that was sort of under the radar.
Oh, perfect. Who is it?
This is Xanthi Alexis. This album just came out last week. It's called Time of War, and the one sheet describes it as blends traditional folk sepia-toned Americana and old-world gypsy jazz.
Huh.
And it's mostly just Xanthi playing her guitar and singing.
Xanthi, is that how she pronounces it? How does she spell it?
Actually, I don't even know. I couldn't find any.
X-A-N-T-H-E. Xanthi. Cool. All right. Here we go.
Of this life, I will bend a burden on the other side. On the other side, on the other side, I will bend a burden on the other side.
Xanthi.
Is she playing the guitar on that?
Yes, that's Xanthi Alexis. She's playing guitar, and you hear the backing vocals. It sounds like there's maybe two other women in the background, and in fact, that is her. And when I was just researching her, there was a story about Harry Nilsson, where a music producer was confused of why he wasn't crediting his backup vocalist in one of his albums. And he said, well, it's because it was all me. So she records in that way. And I think it's really rich and it sounds beautiful. I think her guitar playing, too, the way that she's kind of clawing into that, into the finger picking there, is really dynamic. And it's also very simple, you know. For her quote for making the record, she says, For this record, I knew I wanted the most bare, non-frills sound I could muster. So that meant months of rehearsing and putting the songs together like puzzle pieces. I like thinking of recording as more of a snapshot of a moment. I knew I wanted it to feel very private, and if I overthought the actual recording, that intimacy would be lost. That pressure to get it all in one day pushed me to bring all the emotion to the surface in a raw and uncensored way.
Hmm.
I feel that.
What was that song called?
That was called The Veil.
Interesting.
Do we know where in Colorado she's from?
From Colorado Springs.
Wow.
Huh.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Home and of churches and tattoo shops.
Yeah. It looked like she's associated with Tai Chi and yoga, and I think that she's going to be playing at like a yoga space in Manitou Springs. But I think she, on tour currently, she went to New York City and the East Coast.
Wow. So that's two acoustic women from Colorado Springs that we've heard from on this.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Huh. There's more happening there than I thought.
Yeah.
That I could pay attention.
You got to tune to community radio to find out, right?
Yeah, I guess so. KRCC, I'll bet they play her. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not. Yeah. Who knows?
Well, we do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all that matters, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just like Erica Funge said, we have good music taste.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of good music taste, how about one from Australia?
Ooh.
Yeah. It's called Bombay Royale. They're an 11-piece band, and they're dressed up like March 4th marching band, although I don't think they're like March 4th at all, and certainly the music isn't like March 4th, but... you know, firmly rooted in Bollywood, but some funk influence, some disco influence, and this song, Nucky Day, Nucky Da, Nucky Do.
All right.
Is that like Monkey See, Monkey Do? Let's see.
Bye. Bombay Royale. Nucky day, nucky da, nucky do.
That was awesome.
I liked that. Dance, dance, dance.
Yeah, it was fun.
I just never thought I would hear Bollywood music from Australia, you know?
Uh-huh.
I love it.
Only kinda makes sense, doesn't it?
Only from the DJ of Beyond Beyond would we get something that unique.
Well, you know, it just happened to land in my lap, just like all the music at KD&K does.
And this album has some weirder kind of Indian sitar kind of work, too, that aren't just like upbeat, like dance songs.
Oh,
like
nice.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. See, I've barely even checked it out. We've had it for just a couple weeks, haven't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, by the time this airs, we will have had it for a long time. But anyway, whatever. I don't, who cares? I'm sorry. You can delete
that. It's true.
Well, and so, Luke, in all your time at KD&K, how much music do we get from Australia? You know, I mean, there's...
Not a whole lot, you know? Not a whole lot. There's some singer-songwritery stuff
is,
that we've gotten.
Is Casey Chambers from there?
Yes.
And then Courtney Barnett, is she Australia or New Zealand?
She's Australian.
Okay. Oh. So there's some good stuff coming out of
maybe
there.
Maybe not. Actually, she might be from New Zealand. Better check that one.
I thought...
There's one I remember, Jeffrey Gurumul. Did you ever pick up Jeffrey Gurumul?
No.
He's actually Aboriginal, but he doesn't do didgeridoo. He plays the acoustic guitar. He's like an acoustic troubadour.
What,
from...
What about C.W. Stone King?
There you go. There's another Aussie.
That was like one of my favorite albums last year.
Yeah, Courtney Barnett's definitely Australia. So there is some good, you know, hip stuff coming out of there. I guess now that you mention it. But it's still, I never thought that I would be... listening to Bombay Royale from Australia. That was definitely a one out of left field.
Yeah, they're touting it as a movie soundtrack, but I think it's a movie of their own making. I guess they're legends in their own minds.
Aren't we all?
It appears so in the graphics and this album, the way that they're dressed. Looks like they're having fun.
It definitely looks like they're having fun. Yeah.
Well, speaking of having fun, for this fourth music meeting, we started off in Colorado Springs. We headed to Australia, and now we're going to finish off in France, from Toulouse, France. This is Closy.
What?
Chloe with Black Panther from her new EP Harmony, and she comes from Toulouse, France, and has been blown up stages around the world. I just got to see her in Boulder at the Fox Theater this summer, and she had the entire sold out Fox Theater jumping up and down and sweating and man bunning their way all around the venue. It was amazing. And she doesn't really do a whole lot live. You know, she's one of those sort of electronic artists where it's a lot like a DJ set of her own material. She does a little bit with live drum pads, and she is a guitar player. She has a classical guitar background, but and you'll hear her kind of noodle her way through some of her music. But live, it was just about the power of this kind of skinny, pretty, you know, French girl just bringing it like the boys do, you know. And I think that's one of the things I'm really excited about in electronic music right now is the sort of the rise of the women artists. And when we saw Alicia in Aspen at Belly Up this summer, a bunch of the KDNK DJs went to that. She says, "I'm Alicia and I make my own fucking beats." You know, it's like, it's I think it's one of the exciting things about Chloe is that she's got this kind of force and power and strength to her sound, even though there's a lot of kind of esoteric stuff. And she experiments with different things like the Japanese koto and some of the, you know, field recordings and some of that other stuff that makes it a little more interesting than your standard kind of house music. And she really falls into the category that people are calling world bass. So, you know, there's dubstep and there's bass music. And because she takes these kind of disparate influences and often does remixes of songs that aren't in English, she's kind of had that label put on her. In fact, she won in the UK back in 2003 Best International. In fact, she won in the UK back in 2013 Best International Newcomer. So she's kind of gotten herself onto the map and has shared stages with big names in electronic music like Bass Nectar, Beats Antique, and Bonobo. So what'd you guys think?
It's my favorite electronic thing that you've showed to us so far, Gavin. And I really liked the flute and the keyboard with the bass in there. And I agree that it sort of has this kind of world sound, and I could totally see that fitting in with like a Beats Antique kind of set.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Bonobo.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to see her expand more of the live performance aspect for her sets. You know, for example, she has videos you can find on YouTube where she does a duo with a guy who's called Scarfinger, and when it's Chloe and Scarfinger together, they call themselves Closinger, when they do stuff, she'll be on the guitar and he'll be on the drum pad, you know, the sampler, and they sit there and make beats live. And you can kind of get a little bit more of that flavor of the live set. But when she's the headliner standing up there on the big stage with the big PAs and the lasers pointing in your face and everything, you know, and the giant clouds of weed smoke, you know, going right past you in the crowd and typical Boulder, you know, rave scene, there's just something about the energy. I mean, I don't there have only been a few shows I've ever seen in my whole life where you get the entire crowd jumping up and down like that. I mean, I remember when Rage Against the Machine did their reunion tour, I saw them in the parking lot of what used to be Candlestick Park, and you know, the whole ground underneath us and the pavement felt like it was shaking because everyone was jumping. It was obviously a much smaller show, but you know, she has that same kind of power that Rage has, but in a new era, you know.
Was that before Man Bones?
Right. No, I don't think there are a lot of man buns at the Rage show. But definitely, and she actually rocks what, you know, looks a lot the same style as the sort of the man bun look. But she's like feminine and she has sharp features, but man, she brings it. You know, you feel like she's kind of wiry and like she's kind of shifty. You don't want to mess with her, you know?
Yeah.
Huh. And you know, I don't know a whole lot about her background in Toulouse. But she's been doing these big tours. She's done Coachella. She's been to India. She's done several U.S. tours. And, you know, I think we're just lucky in Colorado that we're on the map for live electronic music because she did 3 or 4 gigs here this summer. And I was lucky to catch the very last one before it was too late. So
cool. Close-y.
Close-y. And I think if you're into that kind of stuff, look up the Sonic Bloom Festival because that's how I first heard about her. And every June down in Rye, Colorado, south of Pueblo, up in the foothills, a bunch of crazy bass music all comes together from around the world. It's really fun.
Was she there this year?
This year she wasn't, but that's where I heard about her last year for the first time.
Cool. Well, another music meeting in the books.
Man, thanks. I love learning about new music from you guys. It's so fun.
Thanks for what you brought, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, Luke.
We'll talk to you again.
Get up, no time to rest or run for cover. Get up, get up, get up before the road pulls you under. Sleeping on embers, breathing in rivers, waking up shivering on summer's hottest night. Salt crusted sweat dries, dust deep in white lines.
Well, that's a little taste of Caitlin Canty. That's the title track from her debut CD, Reckless Skyline, released earlier this year. Caitlin plays Steve's guitars tonight with Peter Bradley Adams. And there's another worthy show at Steve's this weekend on Sunday night. Let Them Roar plays with Boulder's Rebecca Folsom. So let's listen to a little bit of Rebecca's song, Better Times, from her CD, Extraordinary Days.
Everyone's here and the feeling's right. Sky's clear, it's a perfect night. Fiddler's playing our favorite tune. Lovers sway by the light of the moon. Round and round and round and round, my
round
friend.
And round and round, my
up
friend.
And down and up and down again.
Up and down and up and down.
There are times when the storehouse is empty, times when it's filled.
A little taste of Rebecca Folsom, who plays Sunday night at Steve's with Let Them Roar.
Rosemary Wattola Tromer is the Poet Laureate for Western Colorado and a word woman of the first order. She has given many readings in the Roaring Fork Valley over the years and performed at the Launchpad and the Karen Chamberlain Poetry Festival. Rosemary has written a poem a day for more than 3 years and sends them out to her email list of fans every day. She has a workshop tomorrow afternoon at the Basalt Regional Library from 2:30 to 5 p.m. I spoke with Rosemary yesterday by telephone for Ridgeway. Do you think everybody understands metaphor? Is there anybody that doesn't understand metaphor?
I am so glad you asked that question. The answer is that every speaker of every language in the world uses metaphors effortlessly and with great frequency. That is how we make sense of the world. That is what our language is, and that is how the brain works.
So that's because that's the way we think, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the fundamental findings of cognitive science, is that we think in terms of frames and metaphors, which are structures physically present in our brains in the form of neural synapses. It's how we're wired, is to use metaphors to make sense of the world.
Well, I watched your TEDx talk in Paonia, the video of that, and in that you say the frame was kept, but the facts were ignored.
Exactly. That's the danger, right? Is if we're not paying attention to metaphors, if we're not aware of which metaphors are at work, if we've just received the metaphors and we're not conscious of them, then they're still influencing us even though we're not aware of them. It's really, if you think about it, that's how most of advertising works. I mean, there's a lot of people who know how this works, and those people can easily manipulate those of us who aren't being so conscious.
Wow. So there's a novel explanation for the rise of Donald Trump right there.
I don't know if we're going to tackle that one today.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. We'll stay safe.
I can't explain that. That one's beyond me.
Yeah, well, I guess he just has different metaphors than you and me.
I think he does. Mm-hmm. There's a really great book, Luke, called Don't Think of an Elephant by George Lakoff, in which it's a very political book, and he goes into great detail about the right wing and the ways that they have used metaphor. They have, kind of brilliant think tanks that have exploited language and metaphor to create legislation that is often the exact opposite of what it says it is, like the Clean Air Act, for instance.
Yeah. Well, that's the essence of Big Brother. That was the whole message of 1984.
Right. Right.
And the first, right. One of the masters of that, manipulating metaphors, were the Nazis.
So this is interesting, right? Because what we can do with metaphors is so powerful. And it's true on a global level or on a national level, and it's very true on an individual level, for us to... And this is why I think metaphors are so exciting, is because if we can identify these metaphors that are framing our thoughts and defining our actions, then we can change the way we see the world. We can change the way that we engage with the world. And that is thrilling. I think, here's a sweet example from, this isn't from my life, but a story that came from Carbondale. There was a boy there who was going to school at CRMS, Max, who one day was in the middle of the quad weeping. And the math teacher, Tim, comes along and says, "Max, why are you crying?" And Max says, "Gravity. I hate it so much." And Tim says, "Max, think of it like a giant hug, like the earth reaching up to embrace you." Which is, of course, exactly what gravity is. And Max was okay.
Wow. So that Tim, the teacher, changed the frame for Max.
He changed the frame. Gravity went from something that makes things drop, that tears things down, to into something that's reaching up to embrace us.
Wow, that sounds like something Plato and Socrates might have talked about one day or something. That's amazing.
I have to say, I was so impressed with Tim to have that answer so immediately. Yeah.
Yes, very impressive. How about that? Well, Rosemary, we're talking because you are getting set to do a poetry workshop, although I noticed from your website that you don't like to call them workshops. You call them play shops.
Because work sounds like work, right? And, you know, I guess as much as it's true, it could be work. We could call it work if people really want to. Uh-huh. But certainly part of the reason that I continue to write poems every day, you know, for many, many, many years, is because there's so much pleasure in it. And I think that's what I hope we'll explore together, is some pleasure of writing. Writing is such a solitary act, Luke. You know, one of my mentors, A.R. Ammon, says, you know, why would anybody want to be a poet and sit alone in a room all day picking away at your own liver? you know, it's a solitary act. We do. It's very reclusive. However, sometimes we get together. And when we get together, like in a class, like the one that we're going to be doing together on Saturday, or even the reading that we'll be doing that night, when we have this beautiful energy of all these beings, there's communion that happens. It's thrilling, it's exciting, and it's so much more than work. You know, I really think that playing with words is one of the things that brings people to poetry, is a love of language and what happens when we let the words do what words do and how they open us up then.
Well, the play shop is titled Rigorous Willingness, Writing from the Unconstricted Throat. So let's break that down. Tell me about what is rigorous willingness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I think about when I think about writing and when I think about people who aren't writing, why aren't we writing? What keeps us from writing? And for so many people, I think it's a sense of disappointment, perfectionism. They're not going to like what they're going to write. It's not going to be any good. Why even try if it's not going to be great? I think we put an awful lot of pressure on ourselves, and we make this very serious. And I think what's possible, beyond setting out to write something good, is to set out to write something. First of all, just to set out to write something. That's good enough, right? This is the first promise that I make myself every day. I will write something. Hmm. And the next promise I make myself is I will write something that it doesn't have to be good, but it does have to be true. And by that, I mean it has to be something authentic. I can't just be writing it to sound nice. It has to be something that has real resonance for me. And if within this parameter, this is what I call showing up, right, is the willingness to write something and to know that it doesn't have to be good. You just are going to write it because it's true. And I don't mean factual, by the way. Like, it doesn't have to be. It can be fictional, but it has to be authentic.
Right.
And that's, I think, what I'm talking about with this rigorous willingness, is this willingness to say, I will do it. I'll do it. I'm going to show up. And I'm not just going to show up today. I'm going to show up tomorrow, and I'm going to show up the next day. I'm going to keep showing up. I'm going to show up and show up and show up. This, I think, is really what a practice is, right, is the willingness to continue showing up. And the practice isn't, of course, you know, we say practice makes perfect, which is garbage. We're never going to get it right. So I think we say practice makes life worth living, right? Practice, the way we practice is that we allow this poetry practice to show up in every part of our lives and make our entire life that much richer because we are paying attention to the world differently.
Well, how did you become rigorous in your practice? I know you've been writing a poem a day for many, many years. And was it just that, showing up every day?
That is really it. I think that it's quite that simple. But there's a little story behind it, Luke. Oh, 10, 11 years ago or so, my friend, maybe 12, my friend Jude Jeanette was leading a workshop in Salida, and I was in that workshop, quite a few of us, and Jude had just finished doing a poem a day for 30 days, and she put it out there to all of us, that we could do it too. And I remember thinking, no way. Every day for 30 days. That just sounded impossible. But Jude's plan for us was this. She said, find two other people, because one person is going to flake out. So you need to have three. And make a promise to each other that you will send each other your poems every day. That creates a little bit of accountability, which I think is important. And come up with, you know, whatever your own rules are about if you respond or not or whatever. So I immediately thought, okay, I want to try. And I first asked my friend, Ellen, who was sitting next to me. I'm like, Ellen, let's do it. She's like, yeah. And then I chose another woman sitting across the room who I didn't know, but I very much wanted to. She looked and sounded very interesting. And I approached her and said, would you like to try this poem a day thing with us for 30 days? She considered it very carefully and said, yes. So we did. It was an equinox, and we ended up writing our poems every day for 30 days, and we enjoyed it so much that we ended up doing it all the way to the solstice, so a 90-day stint. And then after that, they both stopped. Mm-hmm. But I never did. I just kept going. I thought, and here's what I can say about it, Luke, is that, and this really goes to that rigorous willingness piece. You know, I think sometimes people think, in fact, I had a student today say, I don't think I'm a writer, because writers are people who absolutely have to write. They just have to do it. And that would not describe me. I don't feel like I have to do it. It's really easy for me to not write. Really easy. It'd be so simple to not write anymore. And that's why I have this practice in place, is because it invites me every day to show up. It requires me every day to show up and see what's available and see what's here today. It's different every day, every single day. A blank page every single day. I arrive, I have no idea what's going to happen. And every single day, something happens. It's amazing. It's like it's real magic. Something happens out of nothing. It's so exciting.
Do you do it at the same time every day? In the morning? In the evening?
Yeah, I recently changed. I've always been a night writer, like late night after the kids go to bed. And now I've shifted my schedule so that I wake up quite early in the morning and do my writing in the morning before making breakfast and get everybody out to school. I think it's quite different, too, by the way. I think that writing at night versus writing in the morning is a very different practice.
Oh, interesting.
Just in terms of, you know, at the end of the day, you're kind of full of the day, and it tends to be much more reflective writing. And in the morning, you've got the day in front of you, and it tends to be much more forward-looking. It's interesting how that time shift has shifted things in my writing.
So can you look at all those days of poems and know which ones you wrote in the morning and which ones you wrote in the evening? I don't know.
Here's the other thing, Luke, is that because I write so many poems, I write them and forget them. almost instantly. They just kind of pass through.
Interesting. Now, some of those poems that you've written every day, have they made it into any of your published collections?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's interesting that you bring that up. You know, I think in some ways what I do with having my poems, I put them out every day. I put them out on a blog, and I have email lists. I send them out. So they go out to thousands of people every day. And what I think is kind of funny about that is that every day what I'm doing is putting my rough drafts, my first draft, out into the world. Which is probably foolish, but the other thing that I love about it is always fresh, right? It is always fresh. And then when I'm creating a collection, what I do is I take the ones that somehow stand out to me, and I'll often just, you know, I'll scroll through and look at 100, 200, 300 poems and notice which ones jump out, and I'll pull those, you know, together, and then there's a lot of revising that happens with those poems before they would go into a publication.
Sure.
So I believe very much in craft. I guess it's a very separate process than the generative process.
I noticed that most of your play shops are not so much concerned with craft. They're more concerned with process. Is that a fair statement?
Lately, that's probably true. Yeah. You know, I guess I've done a lot of workshops that are on lately on themes like uncertainty or play or willingness or, I mean, those are themes that are always failure. Those are themes that are very interesting to me. I also do themes, you know, like motherhood where I'm doing, or grief where I'm doing them for specific groups. So that they, I guess what I like is for them to feel open to anyone so that anyone who thought they would want to come, whether they had a lot of experience or no experience at all, could think, oh, well, there'll be a place for me here. And now and then I like to do more focused things, for instance, how to write really good last lines or how to, you know, how to play with meter or how to play with rhyming, you know, slant rhymes. So I guess you're right. I think these days mostly I want to.
Uh-huh. That makes sense.
Play with the larger themes.
Well, the second part of the play shop title, Writing from the Unconstricted Throat. The first thing I think of when I read that is, how do you make yourself unfettered? How do you release the things that keep you from doing what you want to do as far as writing goes? Is that what you're getting at, or is there something else involved?
Well, I think part of what happens, and this goes back to that good versus true, right? And when we want something to be good, we choke. I mean, that's
literally.
I'm sure. Literally. You know, you sit there with your white page and it stays white. You try and speak and nothing comes out because you're afraid it's not going to be good. So how do we open that up? How do we allow this throat, this metaphor for our voice? How do we open up our voice? And I guess I really believe we do it through play. It's just like children, right? The best way to teach children is to play with them, and they learn so naturally this way. You know, instead of doing flashcards, you know, make cookies together. You know, I mean, I guess there's just lots of ways that you can bring information in an engaging, fun way. And so that's, I guess, going back to the play shop idea, too. We'll be doing some games, you know, that will open people up and allow them to be silly so that we can lower our expectations. I guess I think that's one of the most important steps of writing, at least in the beginning, right? You can always have your standard back later. But to start, we need to just open that up. And the way we do that is through play, through allowing ourselves to be open to whatever happens.
Huh. It sounds like it's a process of becoming unselfconscious, or put another way, kind of getting out of your own way.
Getting out of your own way. You could not have said that better. That's exactly it. I mean, we really are our biggest problem. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Yeah, I like to say that the poem knows more than you do. I believe this so much. And sometimes we come to the page with an agenda. I'm going to write about this. It's going to look like this. And this is this completely cuts off everything that's possible to happen in that poem. My friend Catherine Bass, this is my third rule. So far I'm giving you all my rules for myself. The first rule is that I will write. The second rule is that it doesn't have to be good, but it has to be true. The third rule is that I can't know the ending. And I think often that's having an agenda, right? And that's thinking that we know more than the poem. And when we do that, we cut ourselves off from all possibilities of what could happen, what the poem might have had to teach us if we'd stayed open to it. And my friend Catherine calls this, if you know the ending, it's like having an emergency exit, and you just jump out of the poem before it has taught you what it has to teach you.
Oh, huh. That's interesting. That's really interesting. Wow. I wonder, Rosemary, before I let you go here, I wonder if you'd read us a poem.
Mm-hmm. I will. This is one I wrote about failure. It started when a friend of mine, Phyllis, sent me a New York Times headline, and that will be in the title. Here, it's a fairly long title. After my friend Phyllis sends me the New York Times headline, Lou Michaels, all-purpose player, dies at 80, missed kicks in 69 Super Bowl. So I read this headline, right, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's awful. They put his
he's remembered for the worst moment.
They're like, that's terrible. Uh-huh. And so this is the poem that I wrote after that.
Okay.
When I die, let them write about all the mistakes I've made. Let them say in the headlines how many rejection letters I've received from the Sun magazine. Let them say, Mr. Calling for Broadway back in 1987. Let them say, she tried hard, but she never did win a Nordic skate race. They can note how my children always fought in front of company, how the beets in my garden never grew bigger than golf balls, how every chocolate cake I ever made sank in the center, and how I never even watched the Super Bowl, much less knew who was playing for the Colts back in 1969 when Lou Michaels mixed two field goals that helped the Jets win. What do any of us really accomplish? My friend Wayne says we do what we can and have mercy. Yes. Let them say I did what I could. Let them say that I loved the best that I knew how and messed that up too. It's what we do, we who are kicking our way to the back pages of the paper. Fallible and well-intentioned, faithful and confused as we are, we mess up. So yes, mercy on us. Mercy on all our failing little hearts, how they beat so sincerely. Mercy on this longing to shine, to be brilliant, and all these reminders again and again and again to kneel.
To kneel.
Mm.
Ooh. Wow, that was a little bit of an unexpected ending. That's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I am fascinated, Luke, by failure, and notice that I write quite a few poems about it.
Wow, how about that? I love that synchronicity. That's Lou Graham right there.
Isn't that awesome for the car along next to me to go off, right?
I love it. That is really that's really great. You know what?
That's the world for you.
I am not going to edit that out of this. Oh, that is too good. That is great.
Oh, the world just shows up, doesn't it?
Oh, that is an appropriate way to end this. That's really cool. Thanks, Rosemary. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Luke.
Okay.
Pleasure. Thank you for talking today.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye. Rosemary's Play Shop tomorrow at the Basalt Regional Library is preceded by one with James Nave, himself no slouch as a teacher and a poet, that starts at 10, titled Storytelling from the Imaginative Storm to the Creative Form. You can reserve your spot in either or both workshops by calling Alia Howe at 309-2582 or emailing her at aliahowe@me.com. And before I slip out of here, don't forget Celtic Fest tonight and Oktoberfest tomorrow, and also the Studio for Arts and Works, or SAW, celebrates the season with a new exhibition featuring new works from 24 local artists. It's a full studio opening with a live band and art demos from 5 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, September 28th. Let's go out with a couple bits from Denver comedian Troy Walker, who performs at the Temporary in Willits tomorrow night at 8. Don't forget to call to pledge your support to KDNK 963-0139. And please remember to go out there and express yourself.
Had to get a job, big boy job. Here's the thing, I used to think I could never have been a slave. You know, like I would have like made him like kill me or some, you know? But now that I work a corporate job, I know that I absolutely would have been a slave. Like, definitely. Definitely have that mentality. It's like, I have a friend that I work with who's always complaining about how he thinks the company's mistreating us, you know? Like, he's always like, dude, they can't just do this. They can't just take our sick days away and not say anything. They can't do this. We should say something about this. And I'm just like, don't you go starting no troubles now here. These financial folks is good peoples. It gives me lunch breaks and it lets me wear khakis. Even gets cash on Fridays most weeks. Sound to me like some folk just don't know how goods they got to. And he's like, dude, quit f***ing around. Did you really not even read this email from HR? And I'm like, don't let them know you can read. I went to my high school reunion recently, 10-year high school reunion, and that was depressing. Here's the thing that's weird about your high school reunion, right? You go to your high school reunion, and there's all these people that you haven't seen in a really long time, but everybody's doing really well, which is great, but it's also sort of surprising because there's a lot of people you remember being f-ups a little bit, right? But everybody that's actually at the reunion is doing great, and I couldn't really figure out why that was, but then it occurred to me that maybe the reason for that is that a high school reunion is the kind of thing that only people that are doing well are actually gonna go to. You know what I mean? Like, nobody like wakes up on a mattress in an alley like, oh, I gotta be at that reunion at noon. Good thing I stole this watch. Nobody does that. It's like an unwritten rule that you do not go to the high school reunion if you're not doing well. Because it would ruin the reunion for everybody else. Think about that. You like show up to a reunion, there's just some dude in the corner creeping around the buffet, shoving baby carrots in his pockets and sock no shoe, shoe no sock, corduroy cutoffs with a rope belt. And you're like, Steve? What the f*** have you been doing, man? And he's like, ah, you know, just sucking trucker. Can I take some of these shrimp? Are these free?